Welcome to the Eurointelligence podcast. I'm Wolfgang Munchau, and with me this morning are Susanne Munschenk and Jack Smith. So what are we going to talk about today?
I was triggered by your story this morning about the new formula, magic formula, that can be good for the traffic light coalition as well as for the Jamaica coalition.
Yes, this is a fiscal formula proposed by two German economists. And what made this proposal so interesting is that one of them is on the right and one of them is on the left, just like that coalition will be. And it is I would think the first politically intelligent contribution to this debate. It's not necessarily what's going to happen. But the big issue in German policy, the reason why we've been so skeptical about the traffic light coalition, is that it is not clear how you will square the FDP's fiscal conservatism, its refusal to raise taxes, with the SPD's insistence that taxes have to go up, with the SPD's insistence on redistribution, and with this green investment plan of approximately 500 billion euros over a period of 10 years. If you look at the risks that are down the line for the German budget, higher military spending, higher pension subsidies, higher employment subsidies, if you look at all those risks down the line, it is unlikely that the next fiscal period will see very similar characteristics as the last 10 years, where people benefited from windfall gains that the government put into reserves and that allowed it to run fiscal surpluses. We are entering a period where the fiscal side is going to be much more constrained. And therefore, one would need to think about how to square these conflicting demands of the parties with the legal necessity of the German debt brake, which is a constitutional mechanism that ensures that the government cannot run deficits of in excess of 0.3%, 0.35% per annum over the economic cycle. There's a complicated mechanism that ensures how this debt brake works. What this proposal is doing is to ensure that this debt brake can be respected without any excessive legal trickery. Now, one of the assumptions that a lot of people made, including ourselves, so we have to admit, was that the way they would get around it, and this is really getting around it, this is not really respecting it, this is really getting around it, would be to create a special purpose vehicle outside of the government, like a state-owned company that can borrow on the markets. This would be sort of government-backed debt. But a state-owned vehicle under German law has to be independent of the government for this to be possible. So what would happen is you would give you would create a green company and, empower somebody to run this company and give that person, a budget of 500 billion and, you lock the door, basically.
And this wouldn't show up in the deficit statistics.
It would show up in the debt statistics. It wouldn't show up in the deficit statistics. Yeah. But, you will have the big problem with this. And also the big legal risk is that the Constitutional Court will say, look, this is such a massive amount of spending. It is like a quarter of your entire budget. If you give this away to a non-accountable source, you are forfeiting the rights of Parliament.
I was wondering whether the court has also objections on other grounds. We have the rulings in March, which said that the government has an obligation to put out regulations to preserve future generations and to preserve the biodiversity and also the animals for future generations. So there is a clear obligation for the government to deliver. Putting this outside the government's responsibility would run counter this argument, wouldn't it?
That's a very good argument. I hadn't thought of that. I mean, ultimately, it's a conflict for the Constitutional Court because it has to weigh two principles, the principle of its March ruling and the principle that fiscal spending has to be empowered by Parliament. And ultimately, we would be kind of risky to assume how the court would rule. But you're right. It is quite possible that the court say, look, we told you that we needed to do this. This is at least a technical way of doing this. We will need to ensure some. Maybe they will do this with some riders, and they might. I mean, they can pretty much do what they like. If they make exceptions to certain constitutional provisions, they can do that. So that would be, certainly one interesting way forward. What these two economists, Lars Feld and Marcel Fratscher, have produced is a proposal that would not be based on an SPV, on a special purpose vehicle, but on a reserve account inside the ordinary budget. And, you know, to fund this is a heavy act. And to fund this inside the legal remits of the budget is going to be very difficult. They propose to have another year in which the debt break is suspended, a final year, 2022, would under their proposal not be subject to the debt break. So that would be another year of very large fiscal deficits. But they critically also propose that it requires the end of subsidies, like the diesel subsidy and other subsidies that Germany grants. It would require tax reform. It would be a very significant shift, probably the biggest shift to the German fiscal system since the creation of the Federal Republic in 1949. This is a very, very massive shift. Now, if modernization is your priority, you would do this. However, the SPD's election manifesto, you know, it's talk about minimum wages, talk about pension rights. You know, the SPD's manifesto is not exactly about modernization. You know, it is the party with some of the oldest voters, along with the CDU and CSU as well. So this is going to be difficult for the SPD. Now, it is possible that Scholz might say, you know, I can be the chancellor of a modernizing coalition and to the hell with my party. That's quite possible. You know, SPD chancellors have done that before. In fact, you know, every SPD chancellor has done that before. But no, it's not clear that the party will let him or that he will secure the support of his party for such a program.
Yeah, so I drew kind of similar conclusions that maybe it would make sense from a financial or legal perspective, but it would raise a lot of difficulties, I think, from a political one, especially for the SPD. As I looked at it, you know, from your summary, the kinds of programs and subsidies they were talking about curtailing might not necessarily impact younger, more urban-centered Green or FDP voters so much. But as you get to kind of older, more suburban SPD voters, then it would start to have more of an impact, right? You know, thinking particularly about things like the diesel subsidy. And it's such a difficult thing. It's something that we talk about quite a bit with the green transition, where you ideally want to have some way of trying to mitigate those sorts of impacts. Otherwise, it's going to be politically a very difficult sell. You're going to get people, you know, more conservative climate skeptic people coming back in and saying, well, look, these programs are job killers. They're raising your cost of living and they need to go. You can already start to see that. Le Pen said something similar in the French presidential race. You can start to see it in the discussions that are happening at the European level about the emissions trading system. And that would be a kind of big political drawback of that approach, I think.
This is right. The political objections are very serious to this. You know, you mentioned the diesel subsidy. It's easy for the three of us to say, let's get rid of that. But on the other hand, there are a lot of Germans in Germany who have built their lives around commuting, you know, work commuting. They've built houses in rural parts of the country. They're commuting an hour to work by car. They are critically reliant not only on their car, but also on the diesel subsidy, which makes this sort of arrangement that they have made for themselves viable. If the price of petrol and diesel were to double, that arrangement would no longer make sense for many people. That's why subsidies, once they are entrenched, like the diesel subsidy, which has been there forever, it's going to be very hard to get rid of.
The only thing you can say is that after the pandemic, the whole working life reorganization could actually be the chance to do and look into how that affects the different kind of commuting communities.
Yeah, I mean, it will probably. I completely agree. It's an opportunity. I would suspect that many of the commuting jobs, especially in engineering, are likely not to be of the working from home kind. They are much more sort of require presence. The other sort of issue that comes around, the Greens want the phasing out of the motor car. Now, this is the phasing out of the new motor car, not old motor cars. So anyone who's buying a diesel, you know, in this decade will be able to drive that diesel to the end of its lifespan. So, you know, you will have, if you are a diesel fan, you can probably, you know, have and with a sort of 10-year lifespan of cars, which is now fairly normal these days, you know, you can probably drive around with the old fuel-driven cars for another 20 years, even under the green idea, the SPD does, you know, would like to keep the motor car, the fuel-driven car, all the way up to 2035. The French government wants a cutoff date for 2040. So, you know, some of these things may be a long time away, and then these diesel subsidies actually matter, whether you actually give incentives or not. And the case for a cut in the diesel subsidy is very strong. I would suspect it would be phased out rather than gotten rid of, with long time scales so that people can make appropriate adjustments. But that also means that the fiscal effect will be much less than what would be required to fund a, you know, 50 billion euro a year green and digital program, which is about, it's about 1.5% of GDP. This is sort of the order of magnitude we are talking about. And the big sort of macroeconomic question is, you know, let's agree on, you know, they say, okay, let's agree on 1.5% of GDP of investment that we need to do. I think the right and the left agree on that. Where the right and the left disagree is that the right wants to do this inside the debt break, so they want 1.5% less of other spending. And the left wants an increase in the deficit, either directly, which is not possible because there is no majority to reform the debt brake, or indirectly through the trickery of an SPV. That's basically what the argument is about, and what I expect this sort of traffic light coalition to get stuck on. Now today they have, I think, their last meeting of the, you know, talks about talks phase, and they will then go into the proper coalition talks, which is a highly structured dialogue where they will focus on various themes. They have working groups. Each one will discuss a particular issue and come up with proposals. The leaders have a separate discussion group where they take stock of what has been agreed in the working groups. This is a process that could go on for another month or two, but I expect fiscal to be the area where they will get stuck on. There is, by the way, an interesting implication for this for the EU, because this is not just about German fiscal policy. This is also about the Stability Pact.
Will then right end up on the presidency of France next year, right in the middle of when they are campaigning for
Paris. A German present for Macron.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, if they were to adopt this Feldfrutscher proposal, if they were to do this, it would ultimately mean that Germany is unlikely to agree a major reform of the Stability Pact, because it basically means, because the German debt brake was created to instrumentalize the Stability Pact. The original Stability Pact, it was reformed many times, but the original Stability Pact says that that countries should run deficits. There was the 3% in the Maastricht Treaty, but the original pact says that countries should, if their debt is higher than 60%, they should run deficits either in balance or in surplus. That was never instrumentalized. There was never a sort of a procedure in the early days, a procedure to actually enforce this. Now, the six-pack and two-pack and the fiscal compact, they were designed to actually produce the instrument set to enforce this thing. And the German debt brake did this on a national level. So if the Germans continue to observe the debt brake, that would basically mean that the original aspirations of the Stability Pact, the notion of a fiscal neutrality over the long run and a strong emphasis on debt sustainability, will prevail in the European discussion. So what this discussion in Germany is telling me, that the efforts to reform the European Stability Pact might be more difficult than some optimists think what might be possible. One of the issues we have written about this week is the idea of green bonds. Yeah, I think the team has slightly different perspectives on this issue. So we will have probably quite a debate on this. But this week the EU has launched its largest ever green bond. Jack, what do you think is going to, what's the prospect for this instrument?
So I think on the face of it, at least judging from what happened in the issuance, the prospects were quite good, right? You know, the green bond itself was 15 times oversubscribed. I think something that's important to keep in mind about this market, the kind of environmental and social governance bond market, is that at the moment, as almost any fund manager will tell you, there's a big mismatch between supply and demand. You know, investors increasingly want to move to what they view as more sustainable assets. And the fact of the matter is that there just isn't enough of them on the market at the moment. So what you have in effect is that these bonds, regardless of the kind of underlying, you know, I guess you could say creditworthiness fundamentals of the bond, they have a green premium associated with them. So what this means is that, you know, even if your bond should command maybe a lower price or a higher yield, it won't anyways, because people just want these bonds. Something interesting for the prospect of the EU's own green bonds, and just in general for the ESG bond market going forward, is this kind of discussion about Germany, right? Because as far as I'm concerned, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I'm concerned, if they opted for an SPV and they were able to kind of effectively classify their bond issuance as green bonds, that would be, in my view, what they'd be likely to do, because they would, you know, command better market conditions for those bonds. That would lead to a massive uptick in the kind of proportion, I guess, or, you know, just volume of green bonds that Germany is issuing. The German government already issues green sovereign debt, but they issued about 12.5 billion euro of it in this last year. Assuming that they would issue roughly 200 billion euro worth of green investment related debt over 4 years, that means that kind of quarterly they would be issuing about as much in green bonds as they did over the entirety of this past year. So what that would mean is a massive kind of entrance into the market of much kind of safer, like fundamentally safer assets, you know, compared to the EU ones. And that, I think, would start to kind of pull the market apart a bit. You know, firstly, you'd have supply starting to catch up a bit more to demand. And secondly, you'd have a bit more kind of differentiation in the underlying credit worthiness of those bonds.
Yeah, I can see why they want to do this. I'm very skeptical about green bonds, because ultimately this is either government debt or private debt. And if you pay, you know, 0% interest rate for a green bond that is not a sovereign bond, you are paying a lot of money for a high risk instrument. And, you know, an SPV would almost surely be a quasi sovereign bond, so that it, because it's a state owned entity, just as any state owned entity would be a fairly secure investment. I would certainly caution against the idea of classifying debt according to its uses, because the whole nature of government debt is that it is flexible, it can be flexibly used. I'm not entirely sure under this proposal, and I don't think this proposal makes it clear, whether the debt issued for this reserve fund would be officially green bond or whether it would be ordinary, you know, government bond with written in green ink, with a little sort of green wrapper around it. That remains to be seen and probably remains to be structured. But as far as I'm concerned, this is debt. This is straightforward government debt that's been used for that purpose. The idea of earmarking debt, I know that, you know, the whole EU politics these days is all about marketing. They have terms for everything they do. They have this next generation. They have, you know, recoverance and resilience. So they have basically, before they actually draw up the actual content of the stuff, they draw up, you know, the marketing department is busy at creating names and logos, and we've got to be careful about these sort of these wrappers, this sort of wrapper mentality. You know, it's we see that there is huge demand in financial markets. Institutions, you know, have this obligation, moral obligation. They come under pressure from their own people to be green, so that gives them the opportunity to satisfy that pressure. But ultimately, they are either investing in government bonds or in private bonds. And I think a lot of green investment, to my mind, falls more into the risk investments like venture capital than, you know, classic green investment.
I find it interesting that we are now really looking at the concept of sustainability in a very different way than you used to be only a decade ago. Now it's really the investors who want to see how governments spend their money on green technologies. And I would agree with you, Wolfgang, to say if you have an SUV, probably it's very clear that this SUV is delivering the green expenditures. Therefore, you don't have to classify the debt as such as green, whereas when it's part of the bigger envelope from the government, you might actually need that sort of marking on the debt to give the investors the feeling that this is what they actually buy is buying into the green strategy of the government. Whether this is actually matched by it or not, that is of course a different matter. But clear is that the demand from investor side is they want on their books something that is sustainable, and they no longer do want to get told off or sort of take this blind check for the government bonds.
Yeah, I think on the wider issue of whether green bonds, green sovereign bonds, at least are a good idea or not, I'm of two minds on it. On the one hand, I agree with you, Wolfgang, that green bonds are still fundamentally government bonds. They're just used for a different purpose. You know, if a government is or isn't credit worthy anyways, whether they're using this for green investment or not is not going to do much to change that. On the other hand, I think that if we're serious about the idea that the markets have a role to play in the green transition, you really do, as you kind of said, Susanna, need some sort of indication of what this money is actually being used for. You know, because if you're saying to investors, look, we expect you to play a role in this, then the investors will come back and say, but then we need to know whether or not the assets that we're investing in are really a fit for purpose. So on that subject of fitness for purpose, I think it'd be great to move on to some wider discussions about the green taxonomy. Well,
let me first disagree with pretty much everything you just said. It is in the nature of a sovereign bond that it is not fit for purpose. When I invest in the sovereign bond of a country, I know of that country's economic policies. I know about the country's fiscal priorities. If I feel that country is not investing in green technology as it should, I would not buy that debt. The notion of sovereign debt that is earmarked for special purposes is a complete illusion. If I buy genuine green debt, that would be like the debt of an SPV, I take a higher risk. It is quite possible that that SPV, because you know, an SPV can declare bankruptcy without affecting the government. It depends on the legal arrangement between the SPV and the government. But it is possible that some of these green investments could default. They would have a higher risk. They are not sovereign. So if I want something built for a particular purpose, it might be very secure debt. But the debt of the state-owned post office or the debt of a state-owned oil company is not the same as sovereign debt, and the markets price it differently, and institutions have different departments that buy for it. The sovereign debt is something different. The nature of sovereign debt is that has the word sovereign in it. Sovereign debt means countries can default. It's harder these days because of some of the legal rules that have been introduced into bond contracts. But sovereign also means that governments can choose how to spend the money, that I cannot contractually bind them to do that. Once we get these categories mixed up, we are setting ourselves up for significant risk. There is a massive role for the private sector, for private investor in private sector green bonds. We haven't yet seen this big boom. I mean, most of the green investment will be undertaken by the private sector. Mm. We're talking, is it 70%, 80%, 90%? It's in that order. There's no way that governments will invest the lion's share of the green investment tradition. And that's where the fund managers and will ultimately have to invest in. And that would be a sensible idea. But the idea now to use the government portion of the green investment and, you know, market this as a green sovereign bond is, I think, I believe it's a misclassification. And that could ultimately contribute to financial instability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a huge risk that also that you cover up everything, you paint everything in green just because you want to raise the money, and therefore you make it actually, because of the demand, there might be a sort of incentive to create the supply for it, which might not actually be backed up by actions. And then you could either risk default or you could actually risk a bubble because there's so much demand and just slowly building up for it. So I think there still is a risk. And in terms of sustainability, I mean, I prefer the old way of looking at sustainability, whether your economy is growing and looking at growth rates and real interest rates is for me the preferred way of looking at sustainability for public debt.
Yeah, I think on that point, there are two things to say. But the first is that the demand is so high that I think investors are just keen to get their hands on anything green of any sort. The second thing is that, you know, and this comes back to the point about the safety of a particular investment, the particular attraction of green bonds for investors or green sovereign bonds, is that you have an investment which is green like the private ones, but is also viewed as more safe than maybe the private investments are. And that's, I guess, part of the attraction. You know, I do agree with you in the sense that, you know, maybe then you're imposing, I guess, too much conditionality on what a sovereign actually does with those bonds by virtue of the kind of labeling of the bonds for a special purpose. But then the question, I guess, is, you know, how you can equip investors maybe instead of demanding to buy sovereign green bonds, how you can equip them to adequately assess the kind of fiscal policy portfolio of the governments that they're investing in, right? You know, a green taxonomy for these bonds makes it relatively easy for the investors to figure out, you know, what a government is actually going to be spending their money on and how they'll invest it. Otherwise, then you've got to kind of look at what that government is proposing to do. And that will be a lot more difficult for investors to do, I think.
I find it interesting. I just am reminded that we are basically asking the question of who is assessing the accountability of the government spending, whether we leave it to financial markets or whether we leave it to regulators and rules or even the courts. I think we had the same with the Stability and Growth Pact. I remember
revolutionary the voters. No?
Yeah, or the voters. Yes, of course. Exactly. But I mean, I remember the Stability and Growth Pact. We had the same. We had some proposals at that time. We discussed, whereas we said, why don't we leave it to the financial markets to assess the sustainability of government debt, and why do we have to impose rules? And you know, the outcome of this debate was that we had the Stability and Growth Pact. But at that time, we had the same debate, and it was really the question, do we get the pricing right from the financial markets? Who are you going to trust? And in democracies, do you entrust your understanding of what the government spends on to some international investors who have only partial knowledge of what's going on and might not actually spend that much time in the country anyway? So I think there is really also a democratic kind of argument for accountability within the democracy itself rather than to some international market.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the democratic argument will outweigh the other one because it is in the nature of sovereign debt that it is sovereign. So if the voters decide to hell with green, you know, let's have another coal-fired power station, then that's what they will do. There's no contractual obligation that can stop them from doing that. And that's when investors will probably find themselves under pressure. If they want to maintain like a 20% investment green, they might then just switch out of government bonds into private bonds or whatever they will consider green at that time. That's why that's another reason to think that green. I mean, you know, when I saw that they snapped up this green EU bond issue for 0.4%. And in view of everything we know about inflation coming up, I mean, it's not that you have to be alarmist about it, even if inflation just goes back to the ECB's target of 2%, which is sort of a mildly optimistic scenario about inflation going forward. You would probably be stuck with very long-term debt whose value is likely to depreciate in that time, and that might make investors very wary. And you raise the comparison to the early years of the Eurozone, when they all thought the debt of all members of the Eurozone is equivalent, because if something were to happen to Greece or Italy, the others would bail them out. That was the working assumption of everybody in the beginning. And the Eurozone crisis has taught us that that assumption was wrong. You will see that many of these informations, and I agree with you, many of these investors are not fully informed. you know, they may find that that they may look into commitments that are ultimately not, you know, this is politics. Mm. I mean, you ultimately, you know, look at who is governing at the moment and look at how often, you know, Boris Johnson, Angela Merkel, look at how often they have changed their mind on things.
And that's a right for a,
it's what they do.
It's what they do. It's politics. You solve problems. Mm. It doesn't mean exactly that you actually stick to the rules.
And we do that too. No? So, you know, that's why we have to be careful. So I think we want to end this now, because we have now discussed, we spent a half an hour discussing essentially, you know, two subjects at great length. Thank you for listening. And we will be back next Friday.